The wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords, field major Styre of the Sontaran Empire, and the bandaged-faced traffic warden Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels, alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations, and somewhat improbably 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium: TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past, maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
And joining us in The Bunker for this pilot episode of The Bunker is Gareth Cavanagh.
Woo.
It's quite hard for me to talk to you because I know you quite well.
Well, that's good.
And we've tried to, and we've ended up talking off mic about the things we're going to talk
we
about
have.
Now. I just thought Bunker, it's a much more sci-fi
generic
option, and it's nothing to do with a desert island. Take you back to the beginning. Who are you and where did you come from?
All right.
Why are you here?
Oh, well, so like all of us, I suppose, I can't remember a time when Doctor Who hasn't been a part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm from North Wales, from Llandudno. Growing up in the resort of Llandudno, my parents ran a hotel, so we didn't see much of them. And I suppose that's why Doctor Who is both a kind of a thing that we would watch a little bit as a family, but a thing I'd watch alone. Because when my parents were off working in the hotel, because Doctor Who would start in early September.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I remember it. So those early parts of the season when the hotel was still full, I'd watch on my own. And I can't remember a time without Doctor Who. It's amazing. You know, there was nothing else like it. We all think of the 70s as being great, and I suppose it was. There's a 70s of Star Wars and Doctor Who and Blake 7 and Disco and Bowie and Queen, and that's all great. But there's also like a really shit 70s of White Dog Shit and Beige and Ford Allegros,
Formica,
and the Money Program, and terrible hot dogs with no taste. And TV was mostly the latter, terrible 70s. You know, if you think about BBC Two, all that I remember them showing was like the Money Program, Call My Bluff, and the Darts.
I did like Call My Bluff as a kid.
I could see you liking Call My Bluff. You were an intellectual household.
But the Darts still feels like death to me.
Yeah, all of these things were death. You know, if you think back to us, you know, to a Saturday, you had to sit through 6 hours of Grandstand to get to anything remotely worth watching. And ITV might have had, no, they had World at Sport, so it wasn't even, you go, oh, hooray, let's watch something on ITV. So TV was a bleak landscape, occasionally populated by bright things, and one of the brightest of all those things was Doctor Who.
So at what point did you become a fan? I wouldn't say you were a super fan, but you're definitely up there with, in terms of fans that people know about.
I'm not a cardinal. I'm not a monsignor. You know, I'd be a mid-ranking, low-ranking, mm-hmm. you know, well-liked priest in his parish, I guess.
Yeah.
Who doesn't fiddle with anyone.
Obviously.
You know. Yeah, I mean, my first memories are, my first clear memory is The Deadly Assassin. I guess everyone has their first memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the that episode in The Matrix, which was just bizarre, and the big googly-eyed master, and it was just thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
And then Doctor Who, then Leela turns up, and then Doctor Who would remain thrilling, but then was constantly changing. But I didn't really realise it was changing, because you just watched it one a week as a kid. I guess when I really became a Doctor Who fan is when I discovered the Doctor Who books in the junior library. And, you know, and it kind of, it made me and it broke me. Because once someone pointed out, they showed me the library, and I accidentally found Planet of the Daleks. And then someone worked out that you just find books by the author, so it's Dix T.
Mm.
Once I found that, I just didn't look anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I just kept going back to the shelf with Dix T, and a new Doctor Who book would be there every week, or would come back. And all I ever read were Doctor Who books. So
yeah,
I think that's where the obsessiveness, the germ of it, because you realise there was a whole world of adventures that you'd never see.
When do you remember first realising that Tom Baker hadn't always been the Doctor?
That would have been Planet of the Daleks, because Pertwee's on the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you know, it's funny, it didn't even occur to me as like a big deal. It was like, oh yeah, yeah, there's other Doctors. Of course there is.
So your first choice of the five Doctor Who stories, I think the first one to come to, I've decided, is Image of the Fendal, because it's a pretty early one. It's a Leela one, like you say. You would have been aware of it. I take it you watched it on transmission.
Yeah.
But it's also, as we were saying off mic, it's kind of in my head. I keep having to remind myself it's not Philip Hinchcliffe. It's Graham Williams, but it's that era.
It's a hangover
when there's a lot of things that Hinchcliffe has put in place. So we'll come on to talk about your relationship with Philip Hinchcliffe. Mm-hmm. But so what is it about Image of the Fendal? Like, do you remember watching it?
Yeah, I remember watching it. I remember that would have been on after the hotel had closed. I think it's like a November one. So my memory of watching that is we had to go to my auntie's house in the Sticks in Wales, and her TV reception was terrible, and this really irritated me for at least one or two of the weeks, because the picture was crap. But yeah, the skull, the hitchhiker, the horror of it, I mean, it was genuinely terrifying stuff. And especially my auntie's house was this enormous big house in Capel Curig. It was like a big old austere house, wood panelling, hardly any furniture, very empty, very cold, big grandfather clock, a bit like the house in this. So it really really struck me. So it made an impression on first watching, but I can't say in all honesty I understood it, because it's quite sophisticated stuff, Image of Fendal. So it's where it's part of that and Horror Fang Rock are like Hinchcliffe hangovers. And they're, even though Hinchcliffe hasn't planned them, it's Bob Holmes's last flourish. So he's using up ideas that I guess, and he's picked the scripts that he likes, and he's steered those scripts into things that would fit perfectly into any of the Hinchcliffe seasons.
Yeah, totally. And it's not for the first time. It's also got a very Nigel Neal tech.
Yeah, isn't it funny? Nigel Neal,
the hubris of science.
Yeah,
and superstition turning out to have a scientific explanation.
Doctor Who loves Nigel Neal, and it's never been reciprocated. Well, Nigel Neal hated Doctor Who by all accounts.
I mean, in a way, I'd feel a little bit ripped off.
Yeah,
a bit like we'll come on to talk about Alan Moore. I think in a similar way, Alan Moore is ripped off left, right, and centre. And when I've spoken to Alan, I get the impression he's both sort of flattered and never mind, and also kind of furious. But anyway, we'll talk more about Alan Moore later. But Nigel Neal, all my amazing adult sci-fi, has been taken over by this kid show.
It's it's the Stone Tape. It's it's folk horror. But actually, it's one that on a later read, it's one that I came back to as a. I love The Target. Target's great. The Target book is a good example of Terence just tidying up a couple of little loose.
I've got no memory of watching it as a kid, but I remember.
Yeah.
I remember reading the book over and over.
And the scene where Dr. Fendelman, you know, the penny drops that mankind has been used, and we've only existed for this one moment to bring the Fendal back, and he screams, "Mankind has been used," and he goes, "Stahl raised the gun," and then you hear the bang, and it's so much better in the book than in the TV, and it's the same script, but Terence has just reordered a few things, re-emphasised things.
I just rewatched it a few days ago, and actually, it's quite a shock that on Doctor Who they've got people having their, you know, obviously you don't see it, but having their brains blown out.
It's brutal.
And suicide and...
One thing I liked about it as well, I mean, it appealed to my sort of late teens, early 20s. Doctor Who is a very serious, you know, endeavour. It's proper drama. It's peril. It's consequence. It's violence. And it appealed to me there. And then later, but it also appealed because Image of Fendal is one of these stories that you, the Doctor and Leela, you could take them out of it and you could resolve that without the Doctor and Leela. You could... You know, the Doctor turns up and is locked up for at least half an episode, has a little chat with Thea, but doesn't save her, wanders around the woods, and then turns off the time scanner, goes, "Oh, that's a good job, because if I hadn't turned that off, there would be a horrific implosion." Comes back in, chats to a few more people, turns the time scanner back on, and the implosion gets them out of it. Leela is basically just there so that old Mar Tyler's got someone to talk to, and they're like fellow mystics.
Mm-hmm.
You could take those two characters out, beef up Adam Corby a little bit. You've already got Mar Tyler to do the mystic stuff. And Image of the Fendahl could be well remembered as a two-part prestige supernatural drama from the 70s.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got... I always think this about Children of the Stones.
Mm.
That's Children of the Stones is a folk horror that doesn't have Doctor Who in it.
Yeah.
but could, in a weird way, because it's a similar thing of, oh, it's all about superstition, it turns out to be about some mad idea involving a black hole.
Yeah.
It's a Doctor Who plot.
Yeah, it is. It is. And like Children of the Stones, it's grim, you know. I mean, God, I mean, poor Thea. The Doctor doesn't even try and save her. Can you imagine that nowadays?
He would
move heaven and earth.
Everyone
to try
lives,
and, save her.
And she'd, yeah. she'd all the makeup would come off her, and she'd be a normal person.
I mean,
person.
When she's kind of weeping,
yeah,
going, "I need you to help me," and oh, it's grim, it's powerful stuff.
Yeah,
it's clever, and the Fendahl is a good idea. It's a slippery concept. You know, Gary Russell's got the best take on the Fendahl, which he said the Fendahl is death, and he said, but it's not the Grim Reaper. He said, in the split second before anything dies, the last thing it sees is a Fendahl, and I quite like that. And the story fudges it a bit, you know, how do you kill death? Well, it's easy, you drop the skull into a supernova. You know, bish, bash, bosh, job done.
Yeah.
But I do like it.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter.
As we were saying off mic, Image of the Fendahl is, for me, is... I mean, I love Hinchcliffe and Hinchcliffe-influenced. That era is just, for me, is, you know, it's got all the elements of Doctor Who reaching peak.
Mm.
Reaching the peak. But then another side of Doctor Who that I always associate with you and your choices after Image of the Fendahl, as he chokes on his coffee, are what You might sort of call the sillier side of Who, and these are the ones that, in fact, my friendship with you, which is God, I don't know, nearly 15 years now, has made me reappreciate these because I was probably that serious sort of fan that went, oh God,
we all
Horns of Nymon, which still even now divides fans. I listen to Diddly Dum's podcast on it, and it's hilarious hearing Mark defend it and. And Hayden's absolutely hates it.
This is Drek.
I'm kind of somewhere in between now.
Well, listen, I think there's one scene in that which basically divides Doctor Who. And I think how you respond to that one scene basically decides whether you like it or hate it. And that's the scene where he repairs the TARDIS and it turns it on and it all blows up. And then you've got these sort of fizzing spring noises and big hisses. and he goes, that's very odd. And I think if you get to a point, you go, no, this is shit. This is fucking awful. It's a parody. And you can't watch it. That's fair. If you go, oh, that's genius. That's just genius. That's just so good.
I don't know what that leaves me because I don't like that bit.
The main reason I picked it for two reasons. One, because I think there's a definite dividing line between great Doctor Who and lovely Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Horns of Nymon is by no stretch of the imagination great Doctor Who, but it is lovely Doctor Who and it is clever Doctor
and
Who.
Your brief was, what could you stand to be locked for decades in a bunker with?
Exactly. And this,
Talons of Wang Chiang or Horns of Nymon.
Oh, do you know, I love Caves of Androzani, but I haven't watched it for probably 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a much better piece of drama, but I can't watch it. Whereas this I can watch when I'm completely toasted. I can watch when I'm feeling miserable. I can watch when I just need a pick-me-up. I can watch when I'm in a silly mood, I'm happy mood. And it works in all settings. So it's that, and it's that difference between Who that makes you feel warm and fuzzy and Who that you need to show people what the show can do. And I, you know, again, I was that, you know, Ponce Doctor Who fan, in denial as a Doctor Who fan in the mid-90s, living in a student house. And I remember coming back, and they all knew I was a Doctor Who fan, but we never talked about it. And after the pub, they went, oh, come on, let's watch a bit of Doctor Who. I know you watch it. So I went, So I picked Case of Androzani off the shelf. And they just laughed like drains at it, and they thought it was dreadful because all they saw was shonky design, and you know, it didn't fit what they expected Doctor Who to be like. And 25 minutes into it, I knew I was on a losing wicket. I said, hold on, lads, let's change gear. I put on Horns and Eimon, loved it, because it conformed to what they expected Doctor Who to be, which was cheap.
But that is the wobbly sets.
Funny, wobbly sets. Tom Baker on very good form. Lala Ward on very good form. Larger than life villains. So it I mean, it may be...
Massive balls with...
Yeah, heels, massive balls with, you know, you know, with you know, so it I mean, maybe that's a sort of depressing, you know, state of affairs that Doctor Who was held in by the 90s, which is why people like Michael Gray felt very happy punching down at this little show. That we shouldn't be wasting our money unless we need to be making Middlemarch and, you know, the mayor of Casterbridge, not this shite. We need to be making good stuff. And, you know, in some ways that helped them, but...
They defunded it so they can privatise it.
Arguably, yeah, I think they did. So it works on lots of levels. But the main reason I picked this is, one, because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it twice. I enjoyed it first when it was on, because it was Christmas and it was Doctor Who and it was part of that golden lineup of Saturday nights, which included, you know, obviously Vile Savile, but the Generation Game and the Pink Panther Show. God. And all that.
We're almost exactly the same age, yeah, aren't we? So, yeah.
So it took me back. At the time, it was like, yeah, this is Doctor Who, it's great. It didn't strike me as any worse or better than anything I'd watched. It was Tom Baker at the height of his powers. And he's funny and imperious, and it's everything you want that show to be. And then when I watched it again in the early 90s, we used to have this guy he was like our Danny the Dealer of Doctor Who tapes. And we used to buy these tapes off him in, like, pirate Doctor Who tapes in Cambridge. And you paid a fiver an episode. And occasionally he'd let the tape run on and you'd get a free one. We got, like, part three of the, whatever it was, one of the Ice Warriors parts for free. And it was, like, thrilling. It's free. Because he just let the tape run. And when I got that pirate, it was an off-air and it had the Christmas pudding kind of, you know, the BBC had them kind of spinning idents for Christmas, where you didn't get like the globe and the sausage, you got like a Christmas pudding or something like that. And it had that and it took me straight back. And linked to that is Doctor Who's never the same after that. It's the last point when Doctor Who is a popular show that everyone loves. When it comes back in 1980 and everyone's ignored Douglas Adams's law that you can't change a continuing show by more than 15% in a year without someone going, hang on a minute. Come to that year after that, season 18, and gone, actually, there's some really good stuff. But I do remember at the time absolutely hating it. It's like, you know, this is boring. This isn't exciting. This isn't funny anymore. Although it is funnier now when I look back, but it's Tom Baker trying to inject the funny into a show that they don't want to be funny anymore. So Horns and Eimon is like, that's it. You know, you can't say, oh, well, it's only popular because ITV was on strike. ITV was back by then, you know, and they'd thrown some big guns at Saturday night, and Doctor Who is still watched by 9 million people then. Everyone talks about it. So
yeah,
Horns and Eimon for funny, you know, silly, irreverent, wonderful Doctor Who, Tom Baker at the height of his powers, lovely K-9 played by David Brierley, and it's got that Douglas Adams' authorial voice stamped on it. And it's a fertile time for Doctor Who. And I also think it's how the public remember Doctor Who. So coming back to my housemates, it's the bit that Russell T. Davis kind of takes with David Tennant. You know, his Doctor Who is basically later Tom Baker. You know, he's fizzy and energetic.
Yeah, with slight sitcom energy.
Yeah.
Like, which I think... I think Russell keeps it in check, and then I think Moffat goes over, maybe gets a bit too many zingers in.
He's overwriting it, isn't he? Yeah.
Occasionally, yeah.
Yeah.
And
which Tom Baker would have loved. I mean, you get a sense that he's mining those scripts for comic potential.
I mean, I've always got a slight problem with, I love Douglas Adams for Hitchhikers, but I think the tone of Hitchhikers and Douglas's brain doesn't quite chime with Doctor Who. And I think, but Tom, you know, he's on record as when the Cricket Men, when he read the treatment for the Cricket Men, which is such a stupid Doctor Who idea. I'd absolutely go ballistic if that got made into a Doctor Who episode that cricket turned out to be because of... Whereas in Hitchhikers, it's perfect.
Yeah.
But in Doctor Who, that's awful. But Tom liked that. Tom would have happily gone in to a show with the Doctor discovering that cricket was actually the result of...
And he'd have held it together. Yeah, it's the result and of I would have been alien there going, oh. civilizations at war.
I would have, from this distance, I would have there, as much as I can enjoy Horns of Nymon, I would be able to there going, well, this is some awful stuff. I didn't like, I remember at the time, I'm the same age as you, I remember at the time thinking, this looks like it's filmed in like the Blue Peter studio. And I could see, but also, I remember thinking, basing it so closely on the Greek myth of the Minotaur isn't respecting your audience either, because I knew that myth. I knew there were people with bulls, and it all seemed a bit shonky to me.
But you see,
I remember actually being disappointed with Doctor Who, and I was. And what was I, 10?
Yeah.
What year was it?
79.
Yeah. Oh my God, I got jaded early.
But you see, that's something that Graham Williams
I was jaded by Doctor Who.
Mythology. He's interested
Why
in
do
mythology
I still like this programme?
And ancient myths. So
Yeah.
That's these tastes bleeding through. But to be fair to Horns and Nymon, it was meant to be a cheap one.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
they were going to spend all their money on their lavish Sharda end of
season. Well, I always wondered how much the history of Doctor Who would be different if Sharda had ended the season.
It would be seen as a great triumph. The fans would have loved it because it was going to have Daleks and Cybermen and whoever else costumes they could pull out the store. And, and it had lavish location filming in Cambridge. And it was a big... It was going to be a big season finale. So to end on the Horns of Nymon, which I think doesn't get the cleverness it deserves as well, because they knew that was going out at Christmas, and it is quite Christmas panto-y. You know, Graham Crowden Soldeed is terrific.
Yes, I mean...
Come on, we laugh weekly.
Oh,
I kind of love it.
I kind of love it. But I can see why people don't.
We've also got to come back to, you know, the power of television here, you know, because and Doctor Who, because that was a filler, you know, that was a filler Doctor Who, and Doctor Who was a part of the Saturday schedule that no one really expected to be anything bigger. You know, it was meant to be watched once, enjoyed maybe as a target novelisation by 40,000 people who'd seen it out of that 8 points. So the fact that we are 43 years on talking about it endlessly, and it's the only thing that's being talked about endlessly from 1979, apart from maybe Fawlty Towers off BBC.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking about a Bleasdale or a Potter or...
No.
Well, maybe they are, but in very rarefied small circles.
Yeah, you might go to, you know,
the BFI,
a BFI special screening and stuff.
Yeah, and that'll be 200 people going to church.
Yeah, but we've had this with... when we talk about Hinchcliffe... Your buddy Hinchcliffe now.
Indeed.
Like, when I think of Hinchcliffe being taken over by Graham Williams and what the show became, I always think of my dad when he left his work and the guy who took over his job kind of wrecked his department, and my dad was always a bit... Till my dad could shake it off, my dad was always a bit like, what the bloody hell? There goes
well,
my...
Yeah,
but at the same time, it is just a job and it's not your job anymore.
Hinchcliffe went on to do great things, you know, Private Schultz and Nancy Astor and...
Yeah, yeah. I remember that on TV. I remember that was a family, the Nancy Astor thing.
Yeah, there was prestige drama. And I think for a long time, you know, Philip will admit this, you know, Philip, he wasn't sure how he felt about being recognised. You know, that his obituary will lead, legendary Doctor Who producer dies. You know, I think he would be happier that it said legendary TV producer dies. And then it would open with a discussion of Private Schultz and all the other things. And I think as time goes on, the one thing that's never forgotten and is eternally appreciated and released and re-released and reappraised and appreciated is Hinchcliffe. And Hinchcliffe is the king of producers of that show. I mean, yes, Verity starts it, but Verity's part of a bigger team. But Hinchcliffe, yeah, he's special, which is, you know, which is why we're doing the book. We're doing the big Hinchcliffe book that's coming out. You know, the plan is to get that out for hopefully LA in February.
So what's the book on Hinchcliffe? So I genuinely don't know all that
oh, right,
much about
okay.
it. Who's written it? What's is it?
So
is it a biography of Hinchcliffe?
Yeah. So it's an authorised biography with Philip inputting. So about 5-6 years ago, I produced a play with Philip here in Manchester called Virtuoso, which was based on one of...
Which was excellent, yeah.
It was good, yeah, on Philip's TV shows. But obviously, we kept in touch. So he said, I like your stuff. I want you to publish, and I want Graham Burke to write it because I'd met him and I like his biography of Sidney Newman. I think it's really good. So he just put us together and we did a deal, and Graham and Philip been working together on that. I've met Graham. He came over. We had a lovely cup of tea over in Media City, and he's been to the written archives, and he's interviewed loads of people about. So he's interviewed Louise, he's interviewed Tom, he's interviewed Roger Murray Leach, you know, all of the contemporaries, but also people like Stephen Moffat, mm-hmm. to see how that influenced, you know, his appreciation of Doctor Who. And it's so unfair. I haven't picked any of Philip's stuff, and you know, if I was picking one of Philip's, I'd have probably gone with Deadly Assassin.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you! On
coming
you.
Soon to Ray Cummings, phase one of an epic new saga. Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharion. Written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh, the Heretic. Written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega Eltrella, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. Coming soon.
Your next choice, which I would argue is on the silly side, but is a lot more successful, is The Pirate Planet, which, oh, yes. Again, like Horns of Nymon, lots of people hate, and lots of people will, you know, lots of fans will say this is one of the worst, their least favourite episodes of Tom Baker's era.
Now,
but you make a very good case for why it's actually got a lot more going for it.
Got a lot more under. I mean, first of all, it's a much cleverer script, it looks on first, which is the whole point of it, that it opens as, you know, it starts on a sort of comment about inflation and new economic golden ages of prosperity, because the actual big idea that this planet jumps around another planet and the mines suddenly refill with coal or diamonds or whatever, you go, hooray, our mines are full of diamonds. And then it goes somewhere else and it's like, oh, our mines are now full of rubies and everyone's rich in a way that isn't sustainable. So you think it's about that. And then you think, oh, hang on a minute, it's about this shouty, ranty, you know, very, 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 very thinly veiled reference to Long John Silver, and they've given him a bloody robot parrot, and you know, and he's ranting all kinds of rubbish, and you think, oh, well, okay, so that's it. And then actually, you realise there's something else going on, and that the pirate captain is a very sophisticated creation, and that he's hiding inside this big blustering shell, and he's actually a brilliant strategist. It's calculating. He's running his own plan to get out of the corner that he's ending up in, because he's being imprisoned by the Queen.
Long John Silver has a similar function in Treasure Island.
Yes.
So
yes.
He's big and brash, and actually there's a lot more going on.
There's a lot more there.
He's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. So he's hiding. So it is clever, clever, clever stuff. It's conceptually really neat. So this is Douglas Adams. It's his first sort of piece of drama. It's his first bit of Doctor Who. And that authorial voice, Tom Baker really goes for it. And, you know, the Pirate Planet changes Doctor Who forever, because it changes it for the 2 years after. But when the show comes back, that Doctor Who, you could tell, you could remake Pirate Planet, edit it into 50 minutes, you could have David Tennant in there, and it would have all the same beats, and it wouldn't feel out of place in a way that if you tried to redo pretty much anything else from the 70s, you couldn't do it. But you could do that. Douglas Adams is, it's sometimes forgotten, but Douglas Adams is a massive Doctor Who fan. He is the first Doctor Who fan to work on the show in a professional capacity, you know, as a writer and then as a script editor. And he loved Doctor Who, and all those ideas are in there. And you get a feeling that I know this because me and Mark Griffiths went to meet Douglas's brother a couple of months ago, mm-hmm. To talk about the Douglas play that we've done a few years back. And he said, you know, when he did Doctor Who, he said it was a big deal for everyone in the family. We knew he loved Doctor Who. We loved Doctor Who. Everyone loved Doctor Who. And that was the thing he really wanted. He really wanted to write Monty Python and Doctor Who. That's mm-hmm. what he got into the whole business for. And he got to do both brilliantly. And that Adam's voice is there. But it's infused. He's got a good understanding of Doctor Who because he loves it. But he's putting his own spin on it. And it's a big Tom Baker. It's clever. But it's full of all these great performances like Bruce Purchase, Andrew Robertson. And it's clever, it's funny, it's witty, it's thrilling. And it works across the audiences, including, for the first time, that university or public school watching audience full of men in a room who've been in the pub and are quoting along to it. So it's a very important, clever, genius, well-written piece of Doctor Who that changes Doctor Who forever. But I could watch it on its own forever.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
So, just talking about Adams, the legend that is Adams, sort of getting kick-started partly by Doctor Who. And then your one choice that isn't a TV episode is Black Legacy by Alan Moore, which is very pertinent to you, obviously. There might be a reason why you've particularly chosen this, because it's a sort of backup strip.
It is a backup strip. And
for Doctor Who
for
weekly.
Doctor Who, I mean, yeah, it's Black Legacy is brilliant. It's a backup strip with Doctor Who Weekly. When Deskin envisaged it, he wanted to have two comic strips in there, which was based on his House of Hammer magazine format. So you had a main strip, which was your sort of, you know, Mills and Wagner, Dave Gibbons Doctor, 6 pages or 8 pages, whatever it was. And then tucked away in the back would be 2-3 pages of a backup strip where the Doctor never turned up, where the universe had to fend for itself. And it would be a lone Sontaran or people escaping from the Ogrons, and lots of stories about the Cybermen. Interestingly, there's the Cyberman with the soul, Croton, there's Absalom Dark, Dalek Slayer. So
anything I was about to say, anything that Terry Nation doesn't own, but that was sort of at the beginning, wasn't it?
It was at the beginning, and interestingly, all those things are done without Terry's approval, and then they have to retrospectively get Terry's approval. This is why one week in Absalom Dark, Daleks disappear and the Kilmex arrive.
The famous Kilmex.
The famed Kilmex.
I'd love to see the Kilmex appear in the actual TV show.
Deserve an appearance.
Well, we should put them in our comics.
But they were. There was a fascination with the Cybermen.
Who owns the rights to the Kilmex?
Oh, we love the Kilmex.
We should have the Kilmex.
So the Cybermen turn up a lot. And I suspect this is down to Des. Des being, you know, a very commercial big beast, would have gone, yes, I hear your desire to do stories.
Des Skin,
about
of course, we know who Des Skin is very well, because
we know Des.
You especially have hung out with him, but Des Skin, who founded
you've those, fair few times with Des.
I've met him. Yeah. But for those who are listening who maybe don't know who Des Skin is, Des Skin, who founded Doctor Who Weekly, we'll get him on this podcast.
He will
point.
Be on this. Yeah, he's great and well known for his collaborations with Alan Moore.
Well, V for Vendetta. Partly his idea,
indeed.
The seed of it, at least.
Yeah, and so
he's on page one, as he says.
He's
on page one of most concept documents.
Yes, he is, isn't he?
Getting his 10%.
Good old Des.
Amazing guy.
He is, and so these backup strips I liked because there was an idea that the universe had to fend for itself, and the endings were not very pretty a lot of the time, or, you know, they were grim, or they were like score draws, or they were, and the monsters or the villains took centre stage a lot of the time, and this and Black Legacy is Alan Moore's first professional comic strip, paid engagement, and
that's not in Sounds or in the Chronicle and Echo in Northampton.
Yeah, none of that.
I grew up in Northampton, so I know the Chronicle.
This is basically, you know, because Steve Moore, his good friend, has been working on Doctor Who strip since the start, and has brought in Alan to share the load because he's now writing the main strip, or he's doing a lot. He's doing the main strip at this point, so it's a weekly turnaround. It's quite brutal, so he brings in Alan to write this incredible little 4-part story, which is basically a troop of Cybermen on an abandoned world, which was home to the famed Death Smiths, the greatest weaponeers in the galaxy, who disappeared overnight, and they've turned up basically to loot all their great stuff and find the ultimate weapon, the apocalypse device. So that's the germ of it. But what's brilliant about this, and you know Alan quite well as well, is I think it's the start of Alan's brilliant, brilliant, brilliant MO in that he takes the Cybermen. He doesn't really remember the Cybermen. He remembers them a little bit. It's what he said in the, you know, when we chatted. He has a good chat with Steve Moore and they kind of half remember a couple of things about the Cybermen, and he hooks on to the fact that the Cybermen are emotionless and that they have conquered disease. Disease no longer exists. So the idea that they're being stalked by this creature that introduces fear, because it gives them nightmares, and it begins to, it introduces disease, so they literally rust to death. They rot. Yeah. And they die one by one until there's only one left. So it's exactly what Alan goes on to do so successfully with all this stuff with DC. You know, that he takes one aspect of an established property and explores it and does it brilliantly and freshly.
And does it seriously as well. I think that's always his magic. He takes something like Swamp Thing, which is a stupid idea, and makes it... It's all the... A man who dresses up as a bat is a stupid idea.
He makes it
deadly serious.
Serious and interesting, and but with a sound logic to it. You know, I'd never considered this thing about the Cybermen and disease. It's literally a throwaway line, I think, on one of the backs of the Target books, the Tomb of the Cybermen, you know. Years ago, our ancestors freed themselves from pain, disease and fear.
Yeah, yeah.
So bringing that back is really, really clever.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird reading the strip because I just reread it first time in years. And it is weird seeing Cybermen with names. And because we've got Cybermen are a problematic creation because they're almost just robots because they're so unemotional. They're even more unemotional than Daleks. And the idea of...
Well, Daleks have hate, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And anger. They've kept that and got rid of all the other stuff.
And I mean, in the latest Doctor Who, they even had to have a line going with the Master going, so you're going to become robots, is that what you're going to be? And I remember thinking, who would know the difference if the Cybermen became robots?
But not in this. I mean, you know...
No, but in this you have, it's weird because it's of its time anyway, so you can forgive it. But it's... You know, it's a gripping. What is it? 8 pages.
It's 8 pages.
It tells so much story in eight pages.
Incredible economy, isn't it? And you know, he uses, you know, because it is set on, you know, the Doctor would introduce all of these in one panel.
Yeah. Well, this is where it's like we were saying before the podcast started. This sort of comes from the sort of EC Comics horror thing, which is so this is another Dez.
Yeah.
Thing.
It's another Dez kind of pullover with his Van Helsing Terror Tales. But it's the way he continues with that voice, which a lot of those backup strips didn't do, and gives you that godlike narrator. Because I know we had this discussion famously on the roof in Venice Beach. Thought bubbles are shit. I love your thought bubbles are shit rant. When you went, you wouldn't have thought bubbles in From Hell. You wouldn't have Jack the Ripper going, you're nice, I think I'll kill you later.
So Alan
has been consistent to this very first work, and you can see this. And then
he does have thought bubbles in other things. He has thought bubbles in Skiz.
Yeah, but he's trying
But they look weird when you look at...
He's trying to avoid them and having this godlike narrator... pointing out things that they don't know, but we're sharing from, because we are viewing it. It's great. So it's great. It's fun. It does something new with the Cybermen. It's so thrilling. Now, I read that. You know, we didn't have videos back then. There were two media which we could digest Doctor Who over and over and over again. And one of them was the Targets, but the other one was Doctor Who Weekly. And the comic strips, and they became very precious things. And I remember, because the Cybermen had featured so much in those Doctor Who Weekly strips, but not on the TV. I'd never seen them on the TV, because of Revenge of the Cybermen, you know, early 1975, it's if I watched it, I wasn't remembering it. I'd have been, you know, 3. So it gave me this unhealthy fascination with the Cybermen, which was just, but they explored it so well. You had Croton, the Cyberman with a soul, but you had this little diminishing band of Cybermen, and yet he still got the arrogance to go, right, there's that, you know, each one of those would have been a splash. You could easily expand that to God knows how many pages. But that, where he, it's like a gunslinger, and he goes back to the ship and he gets every single gun. Every single gun and bomb, and he's there like a gunslinger. And, you know, I mean, that one page, that one panel is... everything about that Doctor Who isn't, but Black Legacy is. And it's the first time we get a sense that there's a whole universe of adventures, that the Doctor just breezes through these. Like, he's not even on holiday there. It's like It's like us moving through, you know, JFK Airport on the way home.
Mm.
He affects enormous, you know, enormous sort of change, but he's gone. And these guys have got to do it themselves. So in the end, Alan gives him a hero moment because he realises that the creature wants him to take it off world, and if he does that, it's over for everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And presses the button.
In 8 pages, he moves from
yeah.
the setter to the apocalypse device creature.
Yeah.
At the bottom of page 2 to, you know, to all the Cybermen being killed, to, you know, to the lone survivor
sacrifice.
Deciding
yeah.
to blow everything up so that it can't escape. And then the Suntarans arrive and
yeah.
you think, oh, it's going to escape one day. And it's got this message of, you know, very CND, very 70s.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, they won't the futility of it.
Yeah, ultimate weapons don't need to wait forever.
Cybermen having nightmares and going... being driven mad. I mean, it's again the ideas that I'm just like Croton the Cyberman Soul. I'm stunned that they've never arrived on telly. Without Black Legacy and those strips, there would be no cutaway comics. It's as simple as that. Without that realization, there's a world out there bigger than the Doctor. And if once you take the Doctor out, I mean, you're a great writer. You know that the Doctor is a problem because you can't change the Doctor in a plot. You can only have things happen as a consequence of the Doctor going around. You're usually stuck with the noble sacrifice, you know, someone doing the unthinkable, so the Doctor doesn't have to do it, and the Doctor is unchanged by that experience.
Yeah.
And on they go. Once you remove the Doctor from the equation, you know, everything's up for grabs.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
It's probably worth talking about how we talked about how you first got to know Philip Hinchcliffe, but I think in terms of Cutaway Comics, your friendship with Des, I mean, how long have you known?
Well... No, I know Des from... Obviously, I knew his name.
Is this another...
Because he published everything.
You're a fan and you proved you weren't mad situation.
Yeah, I think so. I think what happened was, I get to know Des through Vorp Vorp. So, yeah, it is the same kind of thing, really. So, came about because I was working on... I'd been working on a fanzine called Black Scrolls, and that was coming to an end, and I wasn't really getting on with the guy who edited it. And we had some material, and I thought, well, what shall I do with this material? I'll do a new fanzine. And we'd been working on a book. I'd worked on a book with a couple of guys in the pub, but that never came to anything, on the Doctor Who comic strips. It was going to be like a kind of companion, but it wasn't going to be like a kind of boring, you know, factual guide. It was going to be a thematic approach. So it was going to be sort of one chapter per era. And then we were going to look at one particular story in huge detail, interview the creators and have some interesting stuff, and then a very basic guide to the era. And that never happened. But I did write a sample chapter on The Cybermen, which was the one-page strips from Doctor Who magazine in the 90s, and I'd interviewed Aid and a couple of others. So I had all this cracking material, and I thought, what am I going to do with it? So I thought, well, I'll do a fanzine. Isn't it weird that no one's ever done a fanzine or really explored the comics? Because you've got, you know, all of my heroes, you know, Mills, Wagner, Steve Dillon, Gibbons, all. It'd be great to talk to these guys and use this material. And Des Skin. So I got in touch with Des... probably via, I think he might have had a website, quite an early website. So I got in touch with Des and asked to interview him. So I did a quick pro forma email interview with Des. And then, because I was doing, this is about 2008, because we had the Lasagari at the time. Pub in Manchester, which I, you know, was at the helm of for 9 years. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice to do our own Doctor Who convention, but something thematic? So let's do something on the comics. I've just done all this work on the comics. Maybe we'll have the fanzine out in time for it. And we didn't have the fanzine out in time for it, but we did the comic convention anyway. And I'd used my budget, and then I lastly invited Des, and Des went, oh, so you've asked everyone else and you've left the creator to the end. Thanks a bunch. So I got him up, and he was great fun. We had a good laugh, and he stayed over Brian Gorman's house.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an incredible odyssey across Manchester one evening, and Des, for a half an hour, had left the dummy copy of Doctor Who Weekly in Napoleon's gay bar on the side, and they went, oh, bugger, I need to go back and get that.
Jesus.
So
imagine,
yes,
if that had been lost.
Someone nearly got a great piece there. And so we got on, and then we did Vought Vought. And through Vought Vought, you know, suddenly we
there was a, you know, there was a vessel for people to consider in ridiculous depth and seriousness the whole comics phenomenon. And Des was very generous with his contact book, so Des put me in touch with Dave Gibbons and opened up a few other people. And, you know, I mean, I've always been a great fan of Des. I think Des is very important. Of course, I love him for Doctor Who Weekly, you know, but we also love him for V for Vendetta and all the stuff in Warrior. The Star Wars fans love him for his time on Star Wars Weekly. Mm-hmm. Wizzer and Chips fans love him for Wizzer and Chips. So he's, you know, he's a colossus, but generous with his time, very wise, doesn't always tell you what you want to hear, but what you need to hear. And has been influential with everything we've done with Cutaway. And I think the work stands the test of time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics. It's competition time. Up for grabs this week is the full four-issue story Litten, written by the character's creator, Eric Sayward, with art from Barry Renshaw, and a full four-issue Omega story, which sees Bob Baker's creation brought to life by writer Mark Griffiths and artist John Ridgway. To begin with a chance to win, simply answer this question. In Doctor Who, which actor played the role of Litten? Send us your answers via Twitter messaging or via email to cutawaycomics@gmail.com before the launch of our next episode, and you'll be in with a chance to win. Due to postage costs, physical prizes are only available to UK residents. If you win and you're outside the UK, we'll send you digital versions of the comics instead. Good luck. For more on Cutaway, and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe. So when you're stuck in the bunker and there's nothing but the occasional scarred traffic warden wandering around outside.
Yeah, and a delivery of dog food.
And well, all you have is these five DVDs.
I'll be fine.
So the final one is, and again, this is one I think, if I see this on the shelf, I think of you instantly. And in a weird way, this reason I sort of put it last is it's on the silly side of Doctor Who, but it's also got quite a lot of seriousness in it.
Well, is it?
Which is Earth Shock.
Is it on the silly side of Doctor Who?
To me, it's on the silly side of Doctor Who because it's got
Beryl Reed
in it, and it's got the 80s Cybermen, which I think I can never get on with. The bit in the TARDIS at the end where they're all, the blocking's awful and they're wandering around. So it's kind of, it's got so many clowny, pantomimey bits in it. And Beryl Reed, it's a sort of stunt casting JNT becomes notorious for, which I never quite get on with. Much as I love Beryl Reed.
Okay. Now, let's deal with Beryl Reed, first of all. I mean,
if that was the only stunt casting, I think it would have been fine.
A shrewish, mean-spirited, shrunken little woman who's completely about the bottom line, no shred of humanity left, is a pure evil boss. We've all worked for Beryl Reed, haven't we?
Yeah.
We've all worked for her. I can think of three Beryl Reeds I've worked for off the top of my head. So she's real. If Beryl Reed is
sort of Thatcher.
Yeah. She's kind of, it's all about the money, it's all about the bottom line, it's all about my bonus. If Thatcher had a spaceship, it would be that. So that, and it was always going to be a kind of shrewish woman, but if J&T gets his way, and it's Pat Phoenix, who is Elsie Tanner from Coronation Street at the time, who you can see also had that kind of red hair, you can see as that sort of statuesque, brusque, Northern, but she'd be warmer with it. She wouldn't be nasty and mean-spirited and thin-lipped and, you know, horrible. She would have given it a little bit of trademark warmth.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the same performance. So I think Beryl Reed is kind of integral.
No, I mean, so Beryl Reed is...
And she's quality. Kissed her killing her sister George. And...
Yeah, well, I remember seeing her on, was it Mooncat or whatever it is? On Children's ITV.
Yeah.
Beryl Reed really impressed me in Entertaining Mr. Sloane.
Yeah.
The film of the play. Mr. Sloane. And he goes, I think I'm going to spew. And then she's stubbing fags out in fried eggs and
she's
just amazing, amazing, grotesque
she's a
character.
Tough old boot.
So
she's quality.
First hurdle, yes. I've rewatched Earthshot not so long ago. Quality. And actually she is good. But I think she's also indicative of what, as you know, I'm not a massive fan
it's
in
JNT
general of JNT's
his casting
era.
Muscles.
In his light entertainment.
Now, to be fair at the time, and this is a weakness of the BBC, which JNT is filling the vacuum. Unlike Granada and ITV and people like June West, who we've worked with, you know, ITV and Granada and companies like that employed professional casting directors whose job was to run the rule over talent and, you know, and have all those spotlight books full of notes that you never saw on the other side. Like, you know, I remember June saying that there was a note attached to Glenda Jackson's book that just said Stroppy Dollop.
Stroppy Dollop,
which I think was brilliant. And so the BBC, in their wisdom, didn't have casting directors, so you were in the hands
of
the producer knew. And Philip Hinchcliffe will always say that was where he felt a bit exposed, because he was quite a young producer who didn't have this big... He was dependent on his directors and who the director knew. And a show like Who didn't get the big experienced directors they got...
Mm-hmm.
The new up-and-coming Young Turks, or the ones that were a bit washed out. But in JNT's era, to be fair, he blooded new talent, but these were young directors who didn't necessarily have a big contact book. So if you're casting someone like Captain Briggs, then JNT, who's been at the BBC for thousands of years, will go, how about Beryl Reid? Well, he first says, what about Pat Phoenix? Then he'll go, how about Beryl Reid? So he's filling that gap with his own tastes, which are a bit more on the Morecambe and Wise. And when it works, it works. When it doesn't work, yeah, okay, it doesn't work. So yeah, so Beryl's great. And I think in lesser hands, it wouldn't work, but it does. Yes.
But yeah, so Beryl Reid, okay, legend.
Yeah.
I will forgive her that. Cybermen, 80s Cybermen, I'm never convinced by.
Now, see, I love them, but
are they scary? Do they? I remember being scared by Daleks, even when I was too old to be scared by them.
But you get a proper
chilled by.
You get a proper performance.
I was scared by Resurrection of the Daleks, and that I was 12 then.
Do you know? I nearly put that in instead of Earthshot, because I think the two of them operate the same space in that they're action thrillers being made on the budget of a Terry and June.
But I think Resurrection of the Daleks is far superior, personally.
As a piece of action drama, yeah, possibly.
Yeah.
But are the 80s Cybermen scary? Now, to answer this question, I'm going to go back to Black Legacy.
Mm.
Because there's two reasons I chose Earthshot. Is one, because Doctor Who, Deskin and Doctor Who Weekly had given me an unhealthy fascination with the Cybermen, which I'd never actually seen up until that moment.
Yeah,
and now I could see them. Two, the Earthshock Cybermen are not very far removed from the Black Legacy Cybermen, you know, in that I know they don't have names, but they are emotion, they show emotion, in that they show pride and... They do
that with their fist a lot.
Excellent and all of that. You know, they're not just... toasters like they are in the 60s.
Yeah.
Apart from them first sing-song ones. They're basically toasters. So the way, you know, Big Finish and Nick Briggs, because people do their own preferences, and Nick clearly likes the 60s ones that just talk like, I am a robot.
Yeah.
You will be like us. Whereas you get a proper performance.
I think I
err
on that side, I'm
David Banks.
Yeah.
You get a conversation, a performance in a way that you don't. Because Daleks have got a better voice, but they've got hate.
Mm.
And rantiness. If Daleks were just like, I am a Dalek, you know, like kids would do the impression in the schoolyard as kids.
Yeah, yeah.
You will be exterminated. They're not that. They're screaming.
Mm-hmm.
They're screaming. They're shouting. So the Cybermen have that. There's a lovely vocal quality that I like, and it feeds my Doctor Who Weekly fed Cyberman obsession. And they feel like a continuity, a Black Legacy, to a point where there was one point where the Free Gift of Warp issue 3, we were going to do an audio adaptation of Black Legacy.
Oh, wow.
But we were going to do it with David Banks as the cyber leader.
Oh, wow.
Because he felt like that's what the voice would be. And it was going to be, so we were going to do it, I think it's like an 8-minute audio, so it was going to be the cyber leader doing his last report as he's the last Cyberman. We found out he's the last Cyberman, and then he realises, shit, I'm being hunted, goes off to the ship, gets his big cache of weapons, has the showdown with the Apocalypse device, who I always imagine being like a kind of Anthony Hopkins, silky voice, someone like that. So we were going to get someone with a great silky voice to play the Apocalypse device, and we were going to have that as an 8-minute audio.
Oh, wow.
It's a free gift, and we didn't do it in the end. We did Mechanical Planet. I also picked it because, you know, I remember how thrilling that was to watch first time round.
Well, I remember being absolutely thrilled by it. And because I was going to come on to...
I skipped karate because that was on. It's like, no, fuck karate.
Was this one of the ones that was on in the week?
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
It was like a sort of Tuesday and Wednesday or something, wasn't it? Or Tuesday and Thursday.
I had to choose between still carrying on going to Scouts or watching that. And I dropped out of Scouts, which probably says a lot about my life choices.
I dropped out of karate.
The whole wholesome place where I might learn something, I dropped out.
Yeah.
And so, because it always would clash with Doctor Who on a Tuesday or whenever it was. But yeah, I remember absolutely loving Earthshock. I don't mind it, obviously. I think it's good. But like, because of that, I mean, the whole Adric thing was...
I think he's never better in this.
Well, yeah, but also, I didn't mind Adric. Because when you were a kid, you're not there with a whole bunch of other little fans going, oh, he's rubbish, isn't he? I just remember thinking Adric was a companion and perfectly, he represented me.
Yeah.
He represented me as the young one.
If you're 15 or 17 and you're taking Doctor Who very seriously,
yeah.
And I bet there's Star Trek fans who have the same problem with Wesley Crusher.
Yeah.
He's like, oh shit, so you're riffing me now. You've got this nerdy bloke who's quite awkward and a bit rubbish, and that's me, is it?
Yeah. Everything but an anorak on him.
Yes, exactly. And it's hard. I think he's great in that because he gets time with Davison. Because there are too many companions and he's always crowded out. And interestingly, in this one, they part Nyssa, who I think is the least interesting of the Davison companions.
Mm.
Janet Fielding gets a proper Sigourney Weaver style storyline. Earthshock has... So the first ending's got a great shock ending. The pace is incredibly pacey stuff.
Oh, yeah, no. I remember watching it going, this has got a lot of Caves of Androzani feel, but it's also...
It's all quick cuts and pace, and it's well lit, it's well designed, it's got money. And we've got poor Adric, which I didn't see coming.
No,
you just don't, do you?
It's one of those, for a certain type of British child of a certain age, that black screen is up there with the end of Blake 7 and there's not many other things in childhood.
Well, it's interesting that Blake 7 has just ended 3 months earlier,
right?
So if they survive and Adric, let's say there's another version where they survive and Adric just says, I've been speaking to Lieutenant Scott and he says the computer system of Earth is in a real state after the Cybermen, so I'm going to stay and help them fix it. Adric, I shall miss you, and in that kind of po-faced rubbish way they get rid of companions, so to give him an out like that is strong.
And obviously, Matthew Waterhouse is someone you also know through, not as well as some of the other people we've been talking about.
He's done commentaries for us. I've met him at the BFI. Lovely man.
Mm.
And I think at the time he was obviously upset by the nature of his ending. And now he realises it's the greatest gift he could have had. So there we go. So Earthshock comes with me. But do you know, this is so hard. On another day, Caves of Androzani would be there. On another day, Greatest Show in the Galaxy would be there. On another day, Enlightenment would be there. Tomb of the Cybermen would be there.
You've made your choice now, and you
are. Aztecs would be there, but
we don't know when you're going to be allowed back to the surface.
I'm happy with my lot.
Well, we're talking about Earthshock, which, in a weird way, that's why I sort of put of your choices. I put it last because it kind of encapsulates silly, serious, and Alan Moore, Black Legacy, Doctor Who.
It does,
and your
it's all in
Cybermen
there.
Love
obsession.
So it's kind of all there. Not to mention, you know, the mighty Beryl Reed and Eric Seward as well.
Yeah.
Seward, whose name I can never say right.
Seward.
I can never say his name right.
Seward.
But yeah, who obviously kicked, you know, him writing Lytton.
Yeah.
Kickstarted your cutaway.
He took a punt on us. Do you want a shot wearing one of the Earthshock helmets?
I guess we will.
Yeah.
Let's go and take a picture of an Earthshock helmet.
We can pop it on. I'll get a shot of you.
So yeah. So Gareth Cavanagh, about to put on an Earthshock helmet. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers, boss.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.